Little children are cute. Most of the time, there does come that point in a parent, most of the time, a mother's life, when the reality hits how much I do for you and you don't care. Children are cute, but they are oblivious. They're unaware. They're unaware of the realities of the world. They're unaware of how much they need. In healthy circumstances, little children are wonderfully taken care of. They're oblivious to the miracle that is every single meal is there when they need it. I do think there is a kind of ignorance that is bliss, pure joy. I mean, who among us really wants to know about every danger in the world? Every terror that looms. Ignorance is bliss, but ignorance is dangerous, very dangerous. That's been very clear in the book of 1 Samuel. That's clear in the entire Bible. One of the most dangerous realities of the world is to live in this world ignorant, lacking the right knowledge of the God who has made the world. The God who has made every creature, the God to whom we all must give an account. Now, lest you think that that's just a problem for the world out there, that's a problem for the church in here. The people of God have shown again and again in our own history that we are a people who drift. We are a people who by our life can show we don't really know God. And that's a kind of ignorance that is terribly dangerous. It's the kind of ignorance that marks God's people in 1 Samuel 4, beginning in verse 1, all the way to chapter 7, verse 2. That's where we'll be this morning. And you will want a copy of the scriptures as we work through this passage. The key word is work. This is not a passive exercise. Listening is work. As we come to the text, I want you to remember what we've seen. We've been seeing the slow and steady rise of Samuel and the slow and steady descent of Eli and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. What have we also seen in the midst of all of this is the saving power and purposes of Yahweh. Yahweh is the Lord who has redeemed his people. And the Lord's people again and again demonstrate that they are just like little children, woefully oblivious, ignorant to Yahweh and his saving ways. Could that be said of you? Do you really know the Lord? We'll work through three chapters this morning. Here's the big thing you should know in all three. Rejoice and tremble. Rejoice and tremble. Yahweh needs no help to save. Yahweh, the Lord, needs no help to save. And we'll begin this morning seeing first in chapter 4, death and Yahweh's departure. Death and Yahweh's departure. For Yahweh, you can just write YHWH. It's a way to summarize it. Death and Yahweh's departure. I'm going to begin reading chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. Read along with me. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "A god has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled, every man to his home. And there was a great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the Ark of God was captured. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So here we are in this book that has so carefully chronicled the rise of Samuel. Now suddenly, ominously, Samuel is absent. He will be nowhere to be found in the next three chapters. But what do we find? What is the main character of these chapters? It's the Ark of the Covenant. It's repeated again and again. What is the Ark? The Ark is the golden chest. It's where the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words of Israel were stored. And above the Ark were these cherubim. They were the depictions of suprahuman figures who attend to God, the mighty angels of God. The Ark represents the presence of Yahweh, the Lord. And here in verse 2, the Israelites, Yahweh's people, are defeated by the Philistine. 4,000 are dead. And notice that after defeat, the Israelites do not ask, "Why have the Philistines defeated us?" No, verse 3, "Why has the Lord defeated us?" Now, if only they had stopped for a moment to give even a bit of serious reflection before they reflexively believe that it's because they didn't have the Ark. They take no time to reflect on their own sin, their neglect of the Lord, their desecration of the regulations that the Lord had given for worship. They are like little children. They are oblivious, ignorant of the danger they're in. They are fundamentally ignorant of Yahweh. He was to be the center of their life. He's marginal at best. He's unknown, forsaken at worst. They think of him when they want something, and they use him to get it. When we read Hophni and Phinehas' names, you should have known that's in no way encouraging. They were ignorant, sinful priests. The Israelites, who uniquely have Yahweh the Lord's presence in their midst, have fallen into a superstitious, prosperity-driven faith. This is a man-centered religion. They use the Lord for their purposes, instead of trusting the Lord and being willing to be used for His. Now, you should give honest reflection which one of those characterizes you and your posture before the Lord. And for a second time, verse 5, the Israelites go into battle. The Philistines are afraid. Woe to us. But did you notice that the Philistines aren't totally ignorant? They know something about the Exodus. Verse 8, "Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods?" These are the gods who struck the Egyptian with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Now, they're ignorant in this sense. They think the Israelites are polytheistic. Notice they say gods. But they do know that their gods defeated the Egyptians with plagues. And they fight. And they defeat the Israelites. Can you imagine this scene of death? 30,000 foot soldiers lay dead. Bodies everywhere. And the ark is captured. And just as the Lord had promised back in 1 Samuel 2, 34, Hophni and Phinehas have died. And they've died on the same day. So this is a scene of devastation. Yahweh has departed. And death reigns. And now the news of Yahweh's defeat spreads. Verse 12, there's this man of Benjamin. He runs, that's over 30 kilometers. To Shiloh on the same day. And then there's Eli, verse 13. He's sitting by the road. He's watching. His heart is trembling for the ark. And this man announces the news of defeat to the city. Eli hears the outcry. Verse 14, the man must tell him personally. Eli is now 98 years old. He's now officially blind. When we hear the man's report in verse 17, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the Ark of God has been captured. As soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. The last thing that Eli hears in his life, what actually pushes him over, is the capture of the ark. It was the focal point for the presence of God. And so Eli is a man who dies with the realization that the very thing that made the people of God distinct from the world, the presence of the Lord in their midst, is now over. And in verses 19 to 22, we have more death. Phinehas' wife, she's pregnant, about to give birth. She hears the terrible news of the ark, of her husband's death, of Eli's death. And as she's dying, she brings forth life. She has a son. And as she dies, she captures the devastation of this people as she names her son Ichabod. It means the glory has departed from Israel. For, verse 22, the ark of God has been captured. So in the ancient Near East, if your God was captured by the enemy, it meant publicly your God had been completely conquered. This departure of the ark is the departure of Yahweh. The glory is gone. God's people are defeated. And so also, apparently, is their God. The ark is now safely in the hands of the Philistines. So you and I can use Yahweh for worldly glory, or we can trust Yahweh, seeing his intrinsic worth and his glory, whether we get worldly glory or not. But we can't do both. There is no deals and compromises with the Lord. Israel, as a people, have long at this point turned away from the glory of the Lord, their covenant Lord, and they have turned toward creaturely glory. And now the Lord's glory has departed. So the ignorance of Yahweh's people was their death. It was their defeat. And yet you must see that in their defeat, Yahweh's purposes stood. For just as he promised, Hophni and Phinehas have died on the same day. Maybe, just maybe, Yahweh is the kind of God who can work out his saving purposes when it looks like he has died. I think for us, the warning is to be warned against using the Lord for our ends. The prosperity gospel comes to mind. The Israelites here are treating the Lord as if he's a lucky charm. They just use him when they need him to get what they want. And the Lord is showing us that he will not be reduced to this kind of weightlessness. Did you notice how Eli was described in this text? He's described as heavy. The word heavy is kavod. But Yahweh's glory is kavod. It's heavy. It's weighty. And all human glory is weightless. And the Lord, who will not be reduced to an idol, protects, he preserves, he is jealous for his glory. So in the departure of Yahweh, Israel has lost the kavod, the glory. In sinful ignorance, they have lost what set them apart. I think the worst thing the church can do is to think, oh, we would never do that. That's not us. But I'd argue how weightlessly the Lord rests on the church today. He's treated with casualness. His worship and his word are treated casually. How casually his own people relate to his church, bought with blood by his son. How easily we see the Lord as someone to use when it's convenient. How easily we try to use the Lord for our ends instead of giving up our lives and trusting him to use us for his great ends. Don't believe me? If you're like me, what does your heart do when the Lord says no to you? When it's even the good things that you want in life? What do you do when your life is off course from the plans that you've made? What do you do with the Lord then when he won't change the circumstances that you desperately want him to change? That's when we all learn whether we've come to the Lord for the Lord or just what he can give us, just what he can get us. This is a text that is showing us it is better to have the Lord and nothing that you wanted than to have everything you want and not have the Lord. Here in that day, on that day, death reigns. Yahweh's people have now been publicly humiliated and defeated. The Lord of glory has departed. The ark, Yahweh, is in a foreign land. He's outnumbered. And yet, with Yahweh, there is always hope. In chapter 5, we see death again. Death and Dagon's defeat. Death and Dagon's defeat. Dagon is the Philistine god. Death and Dagon's defeat. And we see in verse 1 that the ark is captured. It's taken to Ashdod. And I'll begin reading in verse 2. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Israel rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priest of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not thread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. So we read of the ark, and Dagon. Dagon. Kids, Dagon is the bad guy in this story. This battle between Israel and the Philistines is ultimately a battle between Yahweh and Dagon. And in defeat, Yahweh becomes one more trophy in Dagon's temple. This is the Philistine Holy of Holies. And yet it is Dagon who has fallen face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So what did they do? They took Dagon. and they put him back in his place. Dagon is a god made by human hands who needs human hands to help him to get back to where he belongs. And so when he falls down the second time, now Dagon's head and hands are cut off on the threshold. And I think you see something of the superstition of the Philistines in the fact that many years after this, when this would have been written, the priest still will not walk on the very ground where their god died, was dismembered, and destroyed. Now think of that. There is an absurdity to their ongoing faith. Instead of walking away from this God who was made by human hands, whose head and hands were cut off by Yahweh, they are still walking by faith in Dagon many years later. So in a world that says, just have faith, the Bible says, be careful in whom you put your faith, for it matters eternally. Yahweh means for his people not to be ignorant that he, the Lord, is independent. He is in Dagon's temple. He is in apparent defeat. And it's there that he defeats the Philistine god. His head is cut off. The God who promised Eve so many centuries before this that there would come an offspring who would crush the head of the serpent is giving a glimpse to his people of his power to do it. Yahweh's victory is in the temple of Dagon. It's in this that he's demonstrating his supremacy and his superiority. Yahweh's people are defeated. Yahweh is not. He is not a God who is made by human hands. He's not helped by human hands. He is independent. So it's in this way, in the very best way, that it is good news that we can say Yahweh loves us, he wants us, but he does not need us. And that's good news because the independent God is dependent on nothing outside of himself. He needs nothing. He is totally self-sufficient within his own being. The independence, the God who has life in himself, not like us. We depend on God for our lives. His life in himself is good news because he does not need something outside of himself to live. Apart from who he is as an independent God, apart from the world, God is God. He needs nothing. So we praise God for this because he's not in any man's debt. He did not create the world or any people because he has need. He did it in love to display his glory. Before the world was created, the independent triune God existed beautifully and gloriously and joyfully within his own being, giving and receiving love among the persons of the Godhead. He did not redeem his people. He did not covenant with his people. He did not give his presence to his people. Because he has need. But in overflowing goodness, he loved his people. He chose to set his love on a people. That is great news for them, for us. I think one of the ways that we would kind of functionally deny this in our lives is when we think, you know, the Lord's love is in some way dependent on me. What I do, decision I made, my performance as a Christian, that's what fickle human love is like. That's not what the love of God is like. He loves because he loves. His love is always bound up in him and his perfections. Never in you, not in me. You can rest there. It's a wonderful thought that the Lord cannot be manipulated. But in his wisdom and goodness, he manipulates us. He changes us to be more like his son. He makes us a people who can worship him as he has told us to. We see his independence in that he defeats Dagon here without the help of his people. He doesn't need help. And it's because he is not dependent upon us that he can fully, self-sufficiently save us. Well, you can imagine the surprise of the Philistines that Dagon was in such disrepair. Let's look at the aftermath of this in verse 6. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people." They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So the Philistines' god, Dagon, had his hands cut off. But notice, they now have the heavy hand of Yahweh against them. The heavy, weighty glory of the Lord that has departed from Israel is now throwing itself against the Philistines. The Philistines, who were so confident that Dagon had triumphed and shown his supremacy over Yahweh, they're now terrified. They're afflicted as Yahweh is demonstrating his superiority to them. But what do they want? They want to get rid of the ark. Verse 7, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us." And so they gather their lords and they ask the question, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They think they'll bring it to Gath, but the Lord's against that city. They try Ekron. It doesn't work. And the Philistines ultimately decide the ark must return so that it might not kill their people. And what do we read in verse 11? There was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was heavy there. Now, the Philistines see and know catastrophic death. Chapter 4, characterized by the death of the Israelites. Chapter 5, characterized by the death of the Philistines. All because of the heavy hand of God. The ones that don't die are struck with tumors. I am reminded of Lucy's ever wise question to Mr. Beaver in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. What does she ask of Aslan? "Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." Outside of the Lord's gracious presence, on his terms, he is not safe. He's dangerous, but he's good. He is the king. Centuries later, Yahweh demonstrates he is still the Lord of the Exodus. He defeats the enemies of his own people by his power. He brings plagues upon the Philistines. He demonstrates his superiority. If you'll remember in the Exodus, it was the cry of the Hebrews that goes up to Yahweh in heaven. But now the Philistines are defeated. They are dominated, and it is their cry that ascends to heaven. Here, the Philistines, who defeated tens of thousands of Israelites, could not defeat the unique, one and only, independent Yahweh. The Lord is a man of war, and he knows how to defeat his enemies. He wins every battle. He always wins. So when God's people see and perceive his glory and align ourselves with his purposes, we are the safest people on the planet. When ignorant of him, we seek to bring him down to our ends. We find ourselves in greater danger than we would ever dream. Death once reigned among the Israelites. Now it's among the Philistines. And yet, without the help of his people, the Lord has defeated the Philistines. But what are God's people at this point? Oblivious. They're ignorant of all of this. And so that brings us now to the final scene, chapter 6 through the first part of chapter 7. Divination and deliverance. A lot of D's. Divination and deliverance. Divination is just trying to seek knowledge about the supernatural by trying to use supernatural means. That's what divination is. It's what we see happening in chapter 6. Look at verses 1 to 9. The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months, and the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place." They said, "If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you." And they said, "What is the guilt offering that we shall return to him?" And they answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land, and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he had dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away? And they departed. Now then, take and prepare a new cart and 2 milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home away from them, and take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put in a box at its side the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way and watch. If it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done this great harm. But if not, we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. So the ark is there for 7 months, and then they call their diviners, and their question, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? It was asked by the Philistine lords. Now it's asked by the Philistine priest. The question is really, what shall we do with Yahweh? They're no longer ignorant of him. They have seen his supremacy and his superiority firsthand. I think they should have stopped and reflected and answered in this way. Let's turn away from our false God and believe in him. Let's humbly come to him. He clearly is no territorial local deity. At this point, they know his reign and his rule. It's so strange that people believe whatever idols or gods they've been born under, they're destined to remain under forever. The Bible is clearly saying that your background and your birth does not have to be your destiny. None of us are born Christians. True Christians have all been born again. So when clear evidence is presented to you that you're wrong, that there is a true God, and all the rest are idols, turn from the idols. Turn to the living God. This is the world we live in. It's so strange that you could dismiss the claims of the God revealed in Scripture with, "I'm glad that works for you. I'm glad that's a help to you." Or you hear the exclusive claims of what Christ has done on the cross and his resurrection from the dead, and you would respond, that's great. But in our religion, the point is, the Philistines, so many others, do not have to worship a God made by human hands or human imagination. They did not have to resort and carry out this divination. They could have repented and come to the Lord. But natural man is strange in this way. We would so rather remain comfortably under the authority and the power of the idols remain in the darkness of sin than come into the light and the love of the Lord. I hope you see that unbelief or belief in the idols is absurd. You see the blinding way that sin works in the world. Yahweh holds his hands out, inviting all who would to come to him in faith. What do these Philistine priests do? They think there's some way they could give a guilt offering, and they do their best. Verse 4, these five golden tumors, five golden mice, they thought that these images would in some way stop the plagues that they had known. Yahweh has departed from Israel. Now the Philistines want Yahweh to depart from them, to get away from them. There's this strange plan. The milk cows and the new cart and the calves are taken away. What's going on? Well, they think that Yahweh is responsible for their defeat, but they want to be sure. They want to make sure there's no coincidence. So these milking cows who've not worked in the field that would naturally go back to their calves, if they go toward Israel, Beth Shemesh, they'll know this was Yahweh. He did it. And so in verse 10, beginning there, that's what they did. Verse 12, the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway. They turned neither to the right nor the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border. Once the ark returned, verse 13, the people of Beth Shemesh who were out in the field see it and rejoice. And then verses 14 to 16, they offer the cows as burnt offerings. Ultimately, it's the Levites who take down the ark, the box, the golden figures inside of it, and set them upon a great stone. They offer their burnt offerings and sacrifices to the Lord. And then verse 18, the great stone which they set down, the ark of the Lord, was a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. This is a enduring picture of the domination of Yahweh. The five Philistine lords are defeated. The stone is the enduring witness. And with the ark's return, Yahweh, who departed in defeat, returns in triumph. In triumph, he ruled. He made a mockery of the Philistines' efforts of divination with the cows. He delivered his people from the Philistines. He did not need the help of even one of his people. Now, do you see the saving stubbornness of the Lord? Here's his people who have ignorantly treated him like he's nothing more than a good luck charm. And here is the Lord who went out and won their salvation while they were ignorant of all of it. The Lord doesn't just know. He knows how to deliver his people. What they could not possibly do in their own strength, Yahweh in his power did in his. Yahweh is the God who goes to the foreign land and defeats the enemies of his people. And he does this when his enemies believe they have brought about his total defeat. As his enemies thought they had accomplished all their purposes with him, Yahweh was the one working in them and through them for his purposes. He judged Hophni and Phinehas. He's making clear he knows how to save. In a very real sense, the glory of Yahweh departed only to demonstrate his own glory, to show how stubborn and able he is to save. When he appeared most defeated, he defeated the idols. He delivered his people. And this ride back on the cows into the camp of Israel was nothing more than Yahweh's victory march. From this text, you are not to be ignorant of the saving way of Yahweh. He doesn't change. The main character in this story is the ark. The main character in the story of salvation is the Lord. If it appeared that Dagon had defeated Yahweh, how much more did it appear that the rulers of this world and the God of this age had defeated Jesus, God the Son in the flesh, at the cross? But then again, in apparent weakness and defeat, even death, the Lord was working for his people's deliverance. Deliverance for his people who were not physically dead, but spiritually dead. In Christ, at the cross, Yahweh triumphed. publicly. Paul writes in Colossians 2, "You who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him." Rejoice. Rejoice. Yahweh needs no help to save. And believe. Turn away from your idols. Come to Jesus Christ, who accomplished a full salvation at the cross without our counsel, without our help. He delivered us. And in his ascension, in his glory, he visibly and publicly announced his reign. We in this world look very defeated, but we are a delivered people, a people whose God has acted upon, who has publicly disarmed the rulers and authorities of this age. And yet, as a people who rejoice, we are always also meant to tremble before the Lord. That's what the Israelites failed to do. In their ignorance, they failed. Verse 19, "And he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, 'Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God?'" Numbers 4 had been very clear. The Israelites were to know that not even the priests were to look at the holy objects even for a moment, or they would die. And here clearly many men did so, that they were investigating what was too holy for their sinful eyes to see. The Lord gives regulation to his people not to restrict us, but to protect us. And tragically, they sound again just like the Philistines. They want the ark of the Lord to go somewhere else. So we read in chapter 7 that the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab, that's Aaron's son, on the hill. And it stayed there a long time, some 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. 20 years, they were ignorant. And I want you to see that ignorance is not always bliss. It is dangerous. However much any parent sacrifices, patiently serves our children, it's infinitely smaller than the sacrifice and the patience of the Lord with his. The Lord means for us as his people to understand deeply that he loves us, that he is purposely doing good to us, but woe to us if we treat him as if he is anything other than the independent, self-sufficient Lord who is holy, holy, holy. For now, today, we're leaving God's people with the ark. Their covenant Lord is with them. But peek over to chapter 7, verse 3. Soon, Samuel, God's man, is going to be present with them again. Soon, in God's kindness, the Lord's word is going to go forward again to his ignorant, sinful people. And that should cause us to rejoice and tremble, for in that there is always hope.